Hello, this is Roz Friedman reading the New York Times Book Review. And this is the weekly section called The Shortlist, which has a theme. And so there are four books under this theme called Culinary Memoirs. And the four reviews are written by Dawn Drizal. The first one is titled Notes from a Young Black Chef, a memoir by Kwame Unawachi with Joshua David Stein, 271 pages, published by Knopf, $26. This rip-roaring tale of ambition is also a sobering account of racism in and out of the food industry. Despite coming from a long line of restaurateurs on his mother's side of the family, Unawachi, as a young black chef from the Bronx, was forced not to just seize his opportunities, but to conjure them out of thin air and bootstrapping hustle. After bottoming out as a self-described drug kingpin, he raised money to start a catering company by selling candy on the subway. Catering led to the Culinary Institute of America, where he helped pay his tuition by continuing to run his business even during a prestigious but punishing externship at Per Se. When he was only 26, he founded the ill-fated Shaw Bijou restaurant in Washington. Undermined by increasing tensions with his over-budget investors and more than a hint of discrimination, it closed after only a few months. Aside from Onwuachi's extraordinary energy, what's most striking about his story is its unorthodox trajectory from rapid ascent to spectacular failure. Rather than ending on the usual triumphant note, this insider's look at the food world concludes with the chef's ruminations about his future and his dream of creating a kitchen full of white, yellow, brown, and black faces. His eventual success lies beyond the book's pages when, unsurprising, given the man we meet in this fierce and inspiring memoir, he landed on his feet as executive chef at Kith Kin in Washington. He was named Rising Star Chef of the Year for 2019 by James Beard Foundation. The second book in the short list of culinary memoirs is Serious Eater, A Food Lover's Perilous Quest for Pizza and Redemption by Ed Levine, 264 pages, published by Portfolio Penguin, and it is $27. Levine, a Knish-loving journalist and accidental MBA, his glazed expression in an introductory finance course prompted the professor to ask him to seriously reconsider his chosen field, founded the trailblazing blog Serious Eats in 2006. Early on, one of his partners issued a prescient warning. People like you who start passion-based businesses do so because they want to spend 90% of their time doing the stuff they love to do and 10% of their time doing other stuff. The sad truth is that those percentages are in fact reversed. Levine's passion and the blog's stated objective was telling people where to eat, what to cook, and what was happening in food culture. But he came to loathe spending almost all of his time on the other stuff. Unfortunately, he tells his story in the same painful proportion. Far too much of Serious Eater details Levine's endless fretting about making payroll, locking in advertising dollars, and especially hitting up friends and family for money. Perhaps he meant to inspire by showing that for 9 years he persevered through it all, but the effect is exhausting. Only in the sparkling interstices when he talks about what he ate at those disappointing business lunches. Shake Shack pro tip. Order a coffee malt and ask for extra malt powder. Do you understand why Ruth Reichel called him a missionary of the delicious? Levine is clearly a nice guy, and one can't help breathing a sigh of relief when he narrowly averts financial ruin by successfully selling the blog in 2015. He gets to stay on, finally free to focus on the good stuff. The next book in the shortlist theme of culinary memoirs is called Burn the Place, a memoir by Ilana Reagan, 266 pages, published by Midway Agate, $25. That's the title of Reagan's memoir. Refers to her fantasy of torching her restaurant with some of the employees still inside, offers a not-so-subtle clue to her temperament and outlook. Being harsh, prickly, and foul-mouthed is nothing new when it comes to chefs, but Burn the Place is anything but a typical chef's memoir. For one thing, most of Reagan's story hardly touches on her career in the food industry, chronicling instead her early struggles with her sexual identity and substance abuse. Only in the last quarter of the book does she finally share her journey to become a celebrated chef from setting up a table at farmers markets to sell pierogi to starting an underground new gathering restaurant and staging in local kitchens to finally founding the Michelin-starred Elizabeth Restaurant and the recently shuttered Bunny Bakery and Kitsune all in Chicago. It's fascinating to get a glimpse of the creative and scientific process behind her unusual dishes, but regrettably, this segment of her story isn't just too short but undermined by a slapdash style. Her book would have benefited from some of the obsessive polish she brings to her food preparation. And the final book in the short list of culinary memoirs is published Hungry: Eating, Road Tripping, and Risking It All with the Greatest Chef in the World by Jeff Gordner. 230 pages, Tim Duggan Publisher, $26. In the spring of 2014, Gordinier was seduced into joining Rene Redzepi in Mexico, the first of many times he would play Tom Wolfe to the peripatetic Danish chef and his gastronomic merry pranksters. Then, working as a food writer at the New York Times, Gordinier badly needed a change, and Redzepi did too, although he was the chef of Copenhagen's Noma, regularly named the world's greatest restaurant. Most chefs with a 10,000-person wait list would be content to churn out expensive meals for a few decades, but Redzepi is allergic to coasting. Gordinier became something of a disciple, periodically accompanying Redzepi over the next 4 years as he opened a Noma pop-up in Sydney. 30,000 on the wait list, closed the original restaurant, opened another Noma pop-up, this time in Mexico at $600 a plate, and launched Noma 2.0. In these pages, Redzepi emerges as an enigmatic and contradictory figure, the chief architect of a new Nordic movement whose Macedonian father emigrated to Denmark, the restaurateur who is driven to build and equally driven to tear down, the explorer who is completely receptive to the moment but for whom there is no now, only next. Gordinier makes a convincing case that Redzepi's genius is irrevocably tied both to his relentless curiosity and to his compulsive need for change, but he habitually goes over the top in trying to find the key to the chef's inspiration and charisma. In the end, readers are more likely to locate it in Redzepi's own Works in Progress, a three-volume set that includes a surprisingly personal journal of a year at the original Noma and 100 recipes. The next shortlist theme is titled Older, Wiser, and Funnier, and the reviews are written by Cherise Wolos. The first book reviewed in this theme is There's a Word for That by Sloan Tannen. 375 pages, published by Little Brown, $28. Lost and profoundly myopic souls abound in Tannen's tale, the YA author's debut adult novel of two dysfunctional families. Marty Kessler, a 75-year-old retired movie producer who made The Geeks the heroes long before that idea had occurred to anyone else, is a mess, as are his adult daughters, Janine and Amanda. The cause, perhaps Hollywood, an industry Marty considers fundamentally corrupt and immoral, or perhaps the Kessler's own tendencies. They have always glossed over the horrors of their lives, and there are many. His fortune is dwindling, a manipulative girlfriend wants what's left, and family unity eludes him. His daughters have been at loggerheads ever since. Janine was a child television star. At 41, Janine is fragile and reclusive, avoiding both the world at large and that of fallen celebrity. Amanda functions but is jealous, divorcing, and raising competitive bratty twin girls. To top it all off, Marty's addicted to opioids. Is this a way to kill time? Because he's old and nobody cares? How decent a man he'd once been, how dedicated a father he was, or how many Academy Awards he had? Bunny Small, newly 70, is the rich and famous author of a supremely successful YA series, YA as young adult. Biting and cruel, she's been hiding in her London flat, stricken by the writer's block she doesn't believe in, drinking uncontrollably. Bunny wasn't dead, but she would have minded if she had been. Her only child, Henry, decamped to Los Angeles at 22 after a life of humiliation and parental neglect, and he's now an art history professor. Bunny explains the separation as her son's decades-long hissy fit because she named the little hero in her novels after him. Where do the orbits of these families intersect? Marty and Bunny, wedded briefly long ago, end up at the same Malibu rehab setting, up a romantic comedy-style meeting involving their respective offspring. The off-minded tropes here would have benefited from more original insights and deeper humor, and the novel's tone never fully settles. Still, one wholeheartedly hopes that they all find some measure of future happiness. And the next book in the older, wiser, and funnier theme is titled Cheer Up, Mr. Whittacomb by Evan James, 277 pages, published by Atria, $26. The San Franciscans Frank and Carol Whittacomb have resettled on Bainbridge Island outside Seattle in a 2-acre Georgian-style home with a bay view, tennis court, beach path, and community gardens. Tended by Marvelous, the gardener Carol, who purchased the property, has named it Willowbrook and has set an intention to cultivate an atmosphere of unencumbered pastoral innocence. Her summer goal is to completely redecorate and get her family to start having more fun. But she's not receiving much cooperation from her loved ones. Now semi-retired, Frank is depressed after graduating from Stanford with a degree in psychology. The author of Zoning Out, a pop psychology book on leadership, has also spent his life guiding multiple generations of San Francisco glitterati toward socially strategic tennis competency. Now he is expected to potter around their mansion like a mellow old patriarch. Exasperating his condition is the cancellation of his annual trip to France with his college buddies, where they lament how so-called success had failed to bring them the unshakable happiness they had longed for as students. And their son Christopher, an art student who's back home for the summer from studying abroad in Italy, is desperate to be disowned by his parents, telling his mother, "I hate the very idea of fun." Enter a young and dashing house guest, the would-be screenwriter Bradford Dearborn, who made up for his carefree loafing with his charm and wardrobe, even if he is heavily self-medicating. Bradford had set his sights on the Whittacombs' able assistant, Michelle, who sometimes suspects she's been hired to serve as witness to the Whittacombs' many dramas and well-heeled existential crises. Last to arrive is the self-help guru, Gracie Sloan, who Frank worries will call upon her punishing New Age worldview to hang a wreath on this hell of inactivity. James's debut novel, a comedy of manners about the banes of upper middle class characters, bubbles with self-realizations. Love in the patois of addiction speak, incipient love that could bridge oceans, and a self-help expo keynote address imploring the freezing of our inherent wilderness, wildness. Poor cheerleader Carol will succumb to depression, but Frank, writing the Whittacomb way to help others master life, will indeed cheer up. The next short list theme is titled Dystopia, and the reviews are written by Chelsea Liu. The first book in this theme is The Diver's Game by Jesse Ball, 240 pages, published by Echo Harbor Collins, $26.99. It's hard to read a book like The Diver's Game, in which an unnamed nation receives an influx of refugees and abandons the notion of human fellow feeling, and not immediately think of the present moment, with its constant news of border atrocities. It was the kindest thing that could be done to admit them because they had nowhere to go, a teacher in the novel tells his students, but they were different than we are, and that fact couldn't be forgotten. To differentiate them from citizens, the immigrants are tattooed, maimed, and confined to law-free areas called quadrants outside of the nation's cities. Quads are free to move between the two areas, but full citizens, Pats, are taught to kill quads at will in the cities by gassing them. As quads aren't legally considered people, violence toward them doesn't truly count as violence. For Pats, gas masks and canisters are everyday accoutrements. In Ball's interlocking puzzle box of a novel, artful and often inscrutable, a narrator slips in and out of the minds of Pats and quads alike. Two young Pat women anticipate Ogeeus Day, a holiday that uses debt forgiveness to bring the nation together, i.e., quell unrest, while the residents of a quadrant called Row House celebrate the Day of the Infanta, a chaotic parade that leads to a particularly dark sort of rioting, an outlet for suppressed rage. Meanwhile, kids in Row House play the diver's game, the goal of which is to swim from one interconnected lake to another through a deep tunnel without drowning. "It's rough, Eben," a quad boy explains. "By the time you get along it, your eyes star up. I mean, you're all dizzy and seeing lights, and then you have to go mad. You have to brutalize and just kick and kick and use it all, and then you end up on the surface." The threat of death by suffocation, a fraught passage from one area to another, brutalizing to survive. The society in the diver's game uses rituals like festivals and games to paper over its own violence. They merely reveal how untenable that violence is. The next book in the shortlist theme of dystopia is titled The Warehouse by Rob Hart, 358 pages, published by Crown, $27. In the near future of The Warehouse, all of our anxious prognostications have finally been realized. Cloud, the biggest electronic retail and cloud computing company in the world, has taken over the American economy, and climate change has rendered vast parts of the world unlivable. The cloud campus, Mother Cloud, where much of the novel's action takes place, sits amid ghost towns and blazing, parched heat. Working at Cloud might be pure drudgery. One character, Zinnia, dashes around the campus's huge warehouse, fetching items and dropping them on conveyor belts for hours at a time, but it beats trying to make a living in the tatters of civil society outside. But life inside, while air-conditioned, is a noxious melange of constant surveillance and sexual harassment, a culture that aggressively pits employees against one another. Paxton, a beaten-down CEO turned cloud security guard, falls hopelessly in love with Zinnia for no discernible reason other than her beauty. Too bad she is a corporate spy tasked by a mystery employer to determine what the Mother Cloud is using as a source of power. Cloud has all the trappings of a sinister tech company, and Mother Cloud's facilities, payment systems, and promotional videos are outlined in excruciating on-the-nose detail. One wishes the novel's characters came with as much depth. Unlike detail behemoth, though Cloud may be, Hart's villain isn't simply a lightly veiled Amazon. Instead, it's the belief that brazen capitalism is the sole solution to the world's problems. A belief embodied by Cloud CEO, the cancer-stricken Gibson Wells, who loathes unions and whose mantra is "the market dictates." It's also the complacency that allows Amazon and companies like it to thrive regardless of the harm they cause. The system is broken. There's only one way to fix it. Burn it down and start fresh, says one of the book's few conscientious objectors. It's not supposed to feel good. As a polemic, The Warehouse is full-throated and sweeping. As a story, though, it might leave customers less than satisfied. And the third book in the dystopia shortlist theme is titled The Nobody People, by Bob Proyle, 496 pages, published by Del Rey, $27. The Nobody People opens with the brutal murder of a family in Wyoming, a fitting start to this sprawling, grim novel about our society's violent inability to deal with difference. The unpalatable oddballs in this case are resonants, people with comic book-type abilities like turning invisible or flying or controlling others' minds. Up until now, no resident has gone public about his or her powers. All that changes when Kevin Bishop, the founder of a school for young residents, asks a reporter named Avi Hirsch to finally reveal their existence to the world. It's not that much to ask to be able to be who you are, Carrie Norris, a teenager at Bishop Academy, tells Avi, to go through the world as a whole person without keeping a part of yourself back. But the world proves highly unwelcoming for people like Carrie. As the news spreads, conspiracy theorists stoke violence against residents, militias establish covert internment camps, and barricades arise. While most of the novel is spent in a few characters' heads, Proyle acquaints us with the names, abilities, and eventual fates of a panoply of secondary cast members. It makes for a bewildering read, both a valiant attempt to delineate an entire society and an unwieldy narrative where depth gets lost in the description of yet another character's appearance or opinions or quickly sketched backstory. I felt a little like one resident who discovers he has eyes all over his body and must shut them against a flood of sheer surface detail. It's clear, though, that there's an unbridgeable gulf between those who are and those who aren't. Fahima Deeb, a mechanically gifted resident, and her non-resident girlfriend Alyssa both join up with the resistance effort. Alyssa wants to know what they're fighting for. Fahima is coming to understand that fighting is a continued condition of her existence. There may not be an end game, only another battle and another after that. It's an idea as unforgiving as the novel's ending, and maybe that's the point. The next short list of theme is titled Spanish Language Novels by Mara Faye Lethem. Mara Faye Lethem is the reviewer of these books. And the first book reviewed in the short Spanish language novels theme is The Dinner Guest by Gabriela Ybarra, translated by Natasha Wimmer. 154 pages, Transit Books, paper, $15.95. The eponymous dinner guest in Ybarra's debut novel is death itself, invisible but with plate, glass, knife, and fork. In this lucid dissection of political violence and open secrets, Ybarra, a Spanish writer from the Basque region, creates a free reconstruction of the story of her family, one of about a dozen who dominated positions of power in the late 1970s in the Vizcaya province, where everything was a politics of the family. The shadow cast by the dinner guest comes first for her paternal grandfather, kidnapped and murdered by Basque separatists in 1977, 3 days after the first elections of Spain's new democracy were held, and then for her mother, dead from cancer a month and a half before ETA, the separatist Basque militant group, laid down its arms. These two deaths dictate the book's structure, its halves hanging loosely together, the hinge being Ybarra's father, who once widowed began to talk about blood-stained rosaries, whereas before, the killing was just a pair of handcuffs in a glass case. Most striking is the narrator's restraint. She recounts the hovering threats to her father's life as blithely as she evokes a lover's ugly brown underwear. Live lightly, her mother advises, before she dies. The worst they can do is shoot me, her grandfather declares before he's abducted. There is a cool appeal to Ybarra's voice, the matter-of-fact way she lays out facts and feelings. I felt a great urge to scream, but I didn't. Yet ultimately, this stiff upper lip treatment instills a disconcerting flatness, making a kidnapping by hooded intruders seem almost banal. Everyone behaved impeccably, Ybarra's father says in a statement to the press after his father's kidnapping. We were calm throughout it all. One wishes Ybarra would occasionally abandon her reserve and let herself scream. The second book in the Spanish language novel theme of the shortlist is titled Springtime in a Broken Mirror by Mario Benedetti, translated by Nick Kastor, 184 pages, published by New Press, $23.99. This novel by the prolific Uruguayan author, journalist, and poet Benedetti, 1920-2009, succeeds as an exercise in empathy and as a visceral record of the ravages of exile, torture, and incarceration on revolutionaries and their families at a time when Uruguayans had been recently disabused of the idea that radical change was possible. Benedetti deploys a series of short, unvarnished chapters with alternating viewpoints to chronicle one man's final moments of political imprisonment. The book opens with a letter from behind bars by the man Santiago, in which he must bear in mind both recipient and the censor before switching to his family's stream of consciousness monologues and then refracted visions of them in the third person. We hear from Santiago's young daughter Beatriz, his wife Grace Ciela, his father Don Rafael, all living in Buenos Aires following the coup in Montevideo that led to Santiago's martyrdom on an installment plan in the ironically named Libertad prison. With impressive resilience, the characters juggle ideals, desire, guilt, and loneliness in their own ways. The sections seen through Beatrice's eyes are the most effective. Forced into a maturity beyond her years, she conveys through her pointed questions, "Is it true Santiago can see the sky? Tell me truthfully, which is my country?" A keen sense of the toll of cultural estrangement. Occasional moments of descriptive grace, "having news from you is like opening a window," are overshadowed by devastating details, such as a postcoital mention of one testicle left forever bruised and shrunken from a cattle prod. Interspliced with the family story are accounts of exiles around the world, including Benedetti's own, highlighting the documentary value of this book, which will continue to grow with time. Benedetti has crafted a portrait of the long parenthesis opened up in Uruguay society from which nobody will be able to pick up the thread of the original sentence. And the next book and third final book in the Spanish language novels shortlist theme is titled Berta Isla by Javier Marias, translated by Margaret Julie Costa. And the title is spelled Berta, and the second word is Isla. Marius' latest novel is a meditation on duplicity and the limits to knowing another person as perceived by the wife of a spy, the beautiful Madrilena of the title. Before their wedding, Berta's fiancé, Thomas Nevinson, returns to Madrid from his studies at Oxford, a tormented, insomniac version of himself. Half British, Thomas is blessed with an extraordinary linguistic skills that catch the attention of M16, and unbeknown to Berta, a misdemeanor has left him no choice but to accept an offer to join the intelligence service, making secrets the foundation and the rule and what controls their lives from then on. How easy it is to be in the dark, muses Berta, who after marrying Tomas gradually realizes how much of his opaque and impenetrable world she is excluded from. She refuses to give up on her commitment to him, sensing that he's still in there half asleep like the victim of some very long enchantment, although what he describes as the defense of the realm seems to her more despicable than war. She accepts the life of Penelope she has chosen, trying to treat his absences as if they were the routine business trips of some restless or perhaps neurotic executive, until one day he simply doesn't return. Years later, she resigns herself to the official version. Her husband was a casualty of the small, unheroic Falklands War. Marias, a celebrated Spanish author, offers up a masterly premise and plot that are worthy of a Hitchcock adaptation, and the denouement does not disappoint. Yet the novel's achievement is marred by baggy prose, indulgent pacing, and dialogue that reads as if life were a long dinner party of droll philosophical anecdotes, and its guests were spies who like to quote T.S. Eliot. And the author's name is spelled Javier and last name Marias. This is Roz signing off for the New York Times Book Review. I will be back next week.